From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman Thomas Suozzi, a Democrat from the state of New York, and we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. A lawyer and accountant by training, Congressman Suozzi is serving his first term as a member of the U.S. Congress. Previously, Congressman Suozzi served as mayor of his hometown, Glen Cove, that's a city in Long Island, New York. As a freshman member of Congress, he serves on the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee, the Armed Services Committee, and is vice chair of the Problem Solvers Caucus. And that's a bipartisan body of 20 Democrats and 20 Republicans who work across party lines to reach consensus. He's also co-chair of Quiet Skies and Long Island Sound caucuses. Congressman Suozzi focuses on issues pertaining to the economy, education, energy, health, and veterans. Recently, he passed his first bill with bipartisan support aimed at reducing waste in the Department of Defense. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Congressman Suozzi about a wide range of foreign and domestic policy issues facing the U.S. Congress, including legislation imposing additional sanctions on Russia, which curtail President Trump's authority to lift them, U.S. policy toward Afghanistan, and many other topics. Congressman Thomas Suozzi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. That was a nice buildup you gave me there. I appreciate that.
Well, we're delighted to host you, and thank you for hosting us in your office. Well, let me talk to you first about your freshman year, Congressman Suozzi. That's extraordinary. Congratulations on your election. Talk about your impressions of being a first-term congressman, especially being in the minority. The Democrats hold neither the House of Representatives nor the Senate.
I love the job. I'm so happy to be here. I've always been interested in public service. As you said, I was a mayor of my hometown for 8 years. I went on to become the county executive of a very large county, $2.8 billion budget, 1.4 million people. I did that for 8 years. But I was in the private sector for 7 years. I lost my race for county executive when I ran for my third term by 386 votes out of 250,000 votes. So I was forced in the private sector. The guy that beat me, though, was just indicted. So, you know, it's not good when you beat me. But I'm very happy to be here. Being in the minority, you know, I'm sure it would be better to be in the majority. But I'm just learning so much. I'm enjoying it. And I believe in public service. I think that public service is still a noble profession. And if you can get people to work together, we can accomplish good things.
I'd like you to talk about some of your major issues, legislative priorities, why you ran, for example.
Like I said, I've always believed in public service and trying to solve problems. And we face a lot of problems in the United States of America today and throughout the world. Here in the United States of America, we've been losing our middle class. We've got more and more wealthy people, and we've got more and more lower income people, but we're losing the people in the middle. And that's always been the great hope of America, has been a strong middle class. That's been the American dream. The American dream has always been that if you're willing to work hard and you play by the rules, then you can make enough money and you can have a home, you can educate your children, you can have health insurance, and you can retire one day without being scared. And that's slipping away from too many Americans because of globalization and because of technology. And that's probably one of the reasons that President Trump won, is he appealed to a lot of people. He spoke to a lot of people about the fact that they've been left behind. Now, I don't agree with President Trump. I didn't vote for President Trump. But he did touch a nerve as far as these people feel that they've been left behind. In America, there are 105 million full-time jobs. And of those 105 million full-time jobs, 59 million people make less than $50,000 a year. 86 million make less than $75,000 a year. So I know this goes to an international audience, and that sounds like a lot of money, $50,000 or $75,000 a year in many places in the world. But here in the United States, in many parts of the country, it's very hard to live the American dream, owning a home, educating your children, having health insurance, and retiring one day without being scared.
Well, following up on that, Congressman Suozzi, you wrote a very interesting opinion editorial in the Wall Street Journal earlier this year focusing on that very topic. You talk about the need to create jobs for not just people with college degrees or in the so-called STEM subjects, that is science, technology, engineering, and math, but jobs for graduates of high schools, trade schools, community colleges. And what you're saying is by doing so, they can make those wages that you referred to that can allow them to support their families. And you say in the article that Republicans and Democrats should pledge to work together to create and fill by 2020 5 million new jobs that pay at least $80,000 a year. Talk about how that's going.
So it's very important to understand what's happened in the world economy over the past 30 years, let's say. America was always the standardized mass producer of the world. We made cars and we made electronics and we made textiles and we made basic simple goods. And then after World War II and the rebuilding of Europe and Germany and even Japan, they started taking over a lot of these different industries because standardized mass production could be done anywhere. First, you needed raw materials, which America had. You needed technology. You needed a labor force that was affordable. And you needed the actual ideas, the science behind it. Well, you can ship the raw materials anywhere now. You can steal the technology or buy it. You can have the different factors that you need for financing anywhere in the world because the world is more stable as far as financing goes. And the labor was often cheaper. And then you saw Japan and Germany move into those areas, but then they moved into higher skilled industries and then lower skilled standardized mass production went to the developing world. First it went to Korea and to Mexico and now it's in Indonesia. It's all over the world now. So we've been saying in America for years, people have to go into higher skilled, high technology industry, and you needed a college degree in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The problem is that in America, 60% of the people do not go to post-secondary education. We've been pushing them. I've been saying it. Economists have been saying it. Experts have been saying it for years. Go get a college degree. The more you learn, the more you earn. We need to recognize that there's a way to earn a good living by being in a skilled workforce job that's not necessarily college. So I talked about the welders, the carpenters, the electricians, the plumbers, the mechanics, the computer machinists. So you don't have to have a college degree in computer engineering, but if you have some basic understanding of how a computer works and how machinery works, these are skilled jobs that people need to be trained for, they need to have workforce development in so that they can make a better wage here in this country.
Well, we wish you good luck in achieving the goal that you've set out in 2020. But let me now turn to foreign policy. I know last week you voted on a bipartisan sanctions bill on Russia. We have an overwhelming round of tough sanctions on Russia passed by both the Senate and the House of Representatives. I'd like to get your view on that sanctions bill, which really ties the hands of President Trump, making it very difficult for him to veto the bill or to lift sanctions because the Congress could override that. Talk about your vote and why you voted the way you did.
Well, I think it's important to understand that Democrats and Republicans are concerned about how the president is approaching some of these sanction issues. There's a battle in the world going on today, and it's not like it was during the Cold War when it was America versus the Soviet Union. It was about ideology of capitalism and communism and democracy and totalitarianism. The battle in the world today is really between stability and instability. A lot of countries were propped up by America or propped up by the Soviets during the Cold War that aren't receiving that type of support anymore. And a lot of countries that are average and below average countries because of either corruption or because of lack of resources or incompetence are failing. And we've gone from 35 million refugees to 65 million refugees in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, there were 35 million refugees in the world. Today, there are 65 million refugees. And there are people that are destabilizing different parts of the world consciously. I'm concerned that Russia is doing that. I'm concerned that Iran is doing that. I'm concerned that North Korea is doing that. ISIS and terrorist organizations are doing that. They want to see instability, and they want to see different states fall apart, and they want to move into the void of that anarchy and try and gain power. Not, I think, for ideological reasons, quite frankly. I think a lot of it's just about making money. And I think a lot of it's about power.
So what you're saying is that's what you think that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, was doing in terms of interfering in the 2016 U.S. election.
Well, you know, I'm not even going to focus on that because everybody sees it as being so partisan. Let's look at Europe and Eastern Europe. Let's look at what's gone on in Ukraine and Crimea. Let's look at what happened in the French elections, the U.K. elections, the Brexit vote. Look at what's happened in Belarus and Estonia. There are efforts in this world today where powerful people with lots of money who, not for ideological reasons, but to make more money, are buying off politicians. They're buying up media companies and influencing the news that people receive. They are buying up energy companies and trying to influence the economies of different countries, all for the purpose of trying to destabilize democracies so that they can make more money and get more power. And there's really an unholy alliance between these different groups. I don't even like calling terrorists terrorists anymore. You know what I like to call terrorists? Criminals. They're the murderers. They're the kidnappers. They're the extortionists. They're the drug dealers. They're taking advantage of people's misery in these destabilized countries, destabilized because of, as I said before, incompetence or corruption or lack of resources, or because of climate change. You know, a lot of problems in Syria, for example, first started because there was a massive drought and people lost their farms. And they fled to the cities to try and find work. And when they got there, they couldn't find work. And they asked the government for help, and the government didn't help them. So they started to say, hey, why aren't you helping us? And that combined with things like the internet, the Arab Spring, they started to foment their dissatisfaction with their government. And that's what started this whole unrest.
Exactly. Well, just let me turn you back.
And unrest is too weak a word, quite frankly.
Exactly.
This whole tragedy.
I'm going to go into the corruption part that you alluded to in a minute, but let's just go back to this legislation, which is quite extraordinary because it's a measure that represents for the first time that Congress, both houses controlled by Republicans, are forcing its will, in a sense, on President Trump on a major policy matter. That is the sanctions on Russia. Of course, it includes Iran, for not just the meddling in the U.S. election, for undermining the democracy. Like you said, one can be a Democrat and Republican and still agree that the Russians attempted to undermine our democracy, also for their nefarious activities and annexation of Crimea and the activities in eastern Ukraine. So you voted, obviously, for that.
Yes, as did just about everybody. I mean, it was a huge bipartisan support. And the reality is that as a former chief executive, I was a mayor, I was a county executive, I don't very easily try and restrict the power of the executive. I don't like the legislative body trying to constrain the power of the executive, as the Congress and the Senate are doing with the president here. But we're concerned that the president has not been responding to the issues that have been raised regarding Vladimir Putin and the Russians. Now, I don't know whether the president colluded or didn't collude, or whether his campaign did or didn't, but there's some unusual relationship that's going on that needs to be investigated. And the president has not spoken out forcefully enough to really say that he wants to get to the bottom of this. And people were concerned. What had happened is that President Obama, after the elections, had two compounds that the Russians control, one of which is in my district, in the 3rd Congressional District on Long Island. He had them evacuated and had deported the people that were in those facilities that we thought were spies. And it's likely. And that was a way to say, listen, this is serious. You can't do this. We're going to hold you accountable for this. And there were a lot of rumblings that the president was considering easing those sanctions and allowing people to come back.
Well, certainly a major question for the many investigations into Russia's meddling in the U.S. election is whether any Donald Trump associates may have acted to help or advise the effort. In that regard, we did see Jared Kushner, the president's senior advisor and son-in-law, go before a Senate investigative panel about his contacts with Russian officials, and we'll see much more of that. And as you said, the apparently over-friendly attitude or posture President Trump has toward Vladimir Putin is of concern to many Americans. In that regard, are you confident in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's ability to get to the truth about Russian meddling?
Yeah, I want to make it very clear. I think that every president wants to try and improve the relationships with other foreign governments. And there's nothing wrong with the fact that the president wants to try and improve relationships with Russia. The problem that exists is that there's all these different relationships that we've seen, from General Flynn now to his son, to his son-in-law, to Paul Manafort, his former campaign manager that was just subpoenaed earlier this week. There's just too many of these coincidences that are all piling up together. And we need the special counsel to really find out what the answer is. And the president should be encouraging that process, not discouraging that process.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. We're talking with Congressman Thomas Suozzi, a Democrat from the state of New York. He's a member of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and the Armed Services Committee. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You could find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Aminu Binji from Funtua, Northern Nigeria. Thanks for listening, Aminu. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And one more thing, we'd like to know what you think of Press Conference USA, so we'd appreciate it if you'd take a brief online survey. You can find it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. Well, back to our special guest, Congressman Thomas Suozzi from New York. Congressman Suozzi, before we leave the Russia matter, I wanted to ask you about legislation that you recently co-sponsored. You have a Fight Russian Corruption Act, because you rightly pointed out that there is so much corruption, and this is a major reason why we need to combat their influence, not only in the United States, but around the world. What is the bill? What is it supposed to do?
I have a bipartisan bill. I have about 10 Republican co-sponsors right now. And the bill is specifically designed to say, listen, Republicans, let's not focus on what's going on in America. Let's focus what's going on in Europe and Eastern Europe, because we need to get to the bottom of what Russia and Vladimir Putin are up to. And this is to have the State Department and the Treasury Department start to monitor the financial transactions and the money laundering and the different things that are happening regarding propaganda in Europe and Eastern Europe. Because the wars in the world today are not the same as they were in the old days. It's not just tanks and troops and bombs. It's also hybrid warfare with propaganda and buying up businesses and corruption. And this is to monitor what the Russians are doing in Eastern Europe and Europe to try and influence and trying to undermine democracies.
Well, and of course, it's very laudable that you have a bipartisan consensus on that. And speaking of which, I'd like you to talk about the Problem Solvers Caucus. You're the vice chair of the Problem Solvers Caucus. It's a bipartisan body of 20 Democrats, 20 Republicans who work across party lines. What problems have you been solving lately?
Well, I don't think that any of them are solved yet, but we're working on quite a few. We're working on tax reform, we're working on infrastructure, and we're now going to work on health care as well, that the Republicans seem to be failing what they're trying to accomplish, which is good for America, quite frankly, that they have failed in this effort. There's so much more that unites us than divides us when it comes to the Republicans and the Democrats here in the United States of America. And we've gotten too caught up in what's going on television and social media. And it's become very small, I believe. You know, I'm on the Armed Services Committee. I went to Afghanistan. I went to Kuwait and Jordan and the UAE. I talk to people all the time about these life and death issues, not only related to our military, but related to here in the United States with issues like health care, life and death issues. And these are serious topics, and they require us to elevate our conversation to the seriousness that they deserve. Politics has become too small and too petty and too personal. And we need to recognize that we have important work to do. People are sick of the politicians. They're sick of the Democrats. They're sick of the Republicans. They're sick of everybody, because they just want us to get things done to actually address the real problems that exist in this world, whether it's health care or terrorism or military issues, or it's issues like creating jobs for people so they can join the middle class again, or the environment, whatever it may be. We need to work together. And the Problem Solvers Caucus is trying to get people of goodwill to try and do that. What's happened in our country, in America, is that very few people vote in primary elections. And there are 435 seats in the House of Representatives. And of those 435 seats, 380 seats or so are safe, guaranteed Democratic or guaranteed Republican. So those incumbents, the people that hold those offices, are not worried about losing the general election to someone from the other party. They're only worried about losing a primary. Democrat could only lose to another Democrat. Republican could only lose to another Republican. So who votes in the primaries? Well, on the Democratic side, people to the far left. On the Republican side, people to the far right. And it's a very small population of people. So they don't do things in the middle that much, because they're afraid if they go to the middle, they'll lose their primary on either side. There was a Republican congressman a few years ago who wanted to work on immigration reform and a path to citizenship. Well, you know what? He got a primary from his far right, and he lost the election. One of the most powerful people in Congress. Eric Cantor was his name. So the idea is that we've got to figure out how can we get people to leave these extremes and focus on the middle, which is what the people want. The people want us to actually fix the problems and address the problems they face.
Indeed, and I'd like to remind our listeners that we interviewed Charlie Dent. He's a Republican from the state of Pennsylvania, who I believe is also a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus.
Correct. Charlie's very much an example of someone who wants to try and work across party lines to try and accomplish solutions.
Congressman Swazi, you just mentioned Afghanistan. I'd like you to talk about your visit there, because this is a very important country for U.S. national security, for the region of South Asia. We have the longest war now taking place in Afghanistan. It hasn't ended. We have challenges with the Taliban, with the so-called Islamic State infiltrating as well. We have more troops going there. But do we have a strategy, in your view? What is the U.S. strategy?
Well, I'm concerned that the president has not outlined his strategy as to what he wants to do. What's very important for people who follow these things to understand is the strategy in Afghanistan is very different today than it was 5 years ago. And this was enacted with President Obama and his military team. And our goal there is really to train, assist, and advise the Afghanis so that they can build their own country and we can work by, with, and through them. Their job is to address the problems of their own country. So there's a 5-point plan in Afghanistan that's been laid out from the military side. We need to have a commensurate civil plan as well. But it's to train the Afghan army to be more effective. It's to train the Afghan special forces to be more effective. It's to upgrade the Afghan Air Force so they can coordinate with the military. It's to upgrade the Afghani police so they can work in regular policing. You can't have the military doing the policing work. And just as importantly, a fifth part of the plan is to really get a handle on what Pakistan's role is in Afghanistan. Why is America still in Afghanistan after all this time? Because there are almost 100 terrorist organizations in the world, and most of them operate out of Afghanistan. So America's big concern is not necessarily about the Taliban, whose Taliban's goal is to take over Afghanistan, but their goal is not to come to America or go to the West. They just want to take over Afghanistan. So that's really Afghanistan's problem to deal with the Taliban. But there are other terrorist organizations located in Afghanistan whose goal is to spend the time there, organize, train, and export their violence and what they're trying to accomplish to Europe and Eastern Europe and other parts of Africa and the Middle East and to America. So we cannot give them any rest. We can't allow them to assemble there and to build these violent anarchy that they want to spread throughout the world. So it's a very big challenge. But all 5 points of those plan are very, very important. We need to also work on the civil side so that the Afghani people start to see their life get better by having a government and be less tribal and be more nationalistic. So there are other problems. You know, it's one of the largest heroin producer in the world from poppy seeds is in Afghanistan. But we need to figure out how to get Russia and Iran in their own self-interest to go after those poppy fields, because they're exporting their poppies not to America. They're exporting it to Iran and Russia and to Canada, quite frankly. So we need other people to take an interest. America cannot do this stuff by itself, not only because we don't have the resources, not only because it's been going on for so long and people are exhausted, but because we don't have the ability to understand all the local cultural issues that are involved with the tribalism and the history of these countries. That's why we need to empower the people from Afghanistan to deal with their own problems in their own country.
Are you concerned that we will be curtailed in that ability given President Trump's 2018 proposed budget, which many people say is dead on arrival, which sees many cuts to diplomacy, to development, which, as you just alluded to, are just part and parcel of a national security strategy? And Congressman Dent also expressed concern about this very issue.
Every single expert, every single general has said if you cut the Secretary of State's office, then you're going to have to buy more guns. Diplomacy is an essential part of the whole of government to figure out how to address these problems. It can't be just a military solution. It's got to be the Secretary of State's office. It's got to be the Treasury Department. It's got to be U.S. aid to provide foodstuffs. I mean, I was at a meeting the other day with a guy who's a former conservative governor of South Carolina who's now in charge of the U.N. food program. And he said, we're the front lines against terrorism. And one of the other conservative Republicans, he said, but yeah, it's the U.N. You know, the U.N.'s no good. He says, well, I don't know about the whole U.N., but this program is essential to ensure that people have a stable life so they're not attracted to joining up with the terrorists.
Indeed, and I know you're very concerned about national security, and that leads me to ask you about President Trump's so-called travel ban, and that's a policy that would restrict citizens from six majority Muslim countries from coming to the United States. The Supreme Court recently ruled on parts of it and let some of it stand, but they're going to look at it in its entirety in October. Do you think this is a wise policy in order to protect the homeland, or are you concerned about that particular policy, the travel ban?
First of all, I think the travel ban is a wrong-headed policy. It makes no sense. It gives aid to our enemies for them to try and recruit more people to say that America is against the Muslims, which is completely not true. But I think that if people are watching this from throughout the world, they should take comfort in the fact that the federal courts have held up a lot of what the president tried to do. And now they have not ruled on the merits of the case. They've ruled on that they could stop the injunction from happening. The courts will rule on it again. And I think that the courts will ultimately find that this is a wrong-headed policy that violates our Constitution.
Well, I'd like you to talk about, for example, some interfaith efforts that I know you champion. I had the pleasure of meeting you at the UAE embassy for an iftar dinner, which, of course, after Ramadan, you break the fast. And I was delighted to hear about your interest in interfaith efforts. What exactly are you doing on that front?
Well, thank you for asking about that. Shukran. I appreciate it very much. I think that we have to understand, the world needs to understand. And the great thing about politics is that you get a window into the lives of different people. And we all share so much more in common than divides us. And we really need to learn more about each other's cultures and our religions and our backgrounds so that we can find out that we're all concerned about the same things. Who loves me? Who doesn't love me? What's right? What's wrong? How am I going to take care of my children? How am I going to pay my bills? Everybody cares about the same things. And the things that divide us are very, very small. I'm an Italian-American. My father was born in Italy. I'm a first-generation American. And, you know, when I go to an Italian-American event, whether I know the people or not, they're like, hey, Tom, how are you? And they pat me on the back because I'm one of them. And they know we went through the same common experiences. We ate the same food. We had the raviolis with the tomato sauce. And we had the red wine. And, you know, there's a picture of a saint from the Catholic Church on the wall somewhere. And there's all these different things where grandma would make the pasta on Sunday. But we all share these common experiences. But as my political career went on and I spent time with different people, from every different background, whether they were from Africa or they were from India or they were from Jerusalem or they were from any country, whether they were Muslim or they were Christian or they were Hindu or they were Buddhist or they were Jewish, whatever it may be, everybody's the same as far as these different traditions that they share in common. They're different traditions, but each group has their own tradition. So we would have these ethnic concerts when I was county executive, and every concert would be the same. There'd be people up on the stage. They'd be wearing a particular costume. They'd be performing some sort of music from their native land. Out in the audience would be the parents would be beaming when their children would be performing on stage. And the elderly people would be treated with respect. And people would make sure that they were seated comfortably. And everybody would want to take pictures together. Everybody has these same feelings for each other. They're just different. A good example I give is when we were growing up in America, we would see TV shows or movies that portrayed the Germans. And we would hear the harsh German accent. And whenever you hear that accent, you think, that's bad. That's the Nazis. That's terrible. Then I remember when I was an older man, I saw Pope Benedict, who is, you know, I'm Catholic, and I heard him speaking with that harsh German accent. I said, what is he saying? It sounds scary. But I knew he was saying the same thing I heard all my life at a different mass. Now people hear people speaking Arabic, and they think, oh my gosh, there's something bad happening, because you only see the videos of the guys speaking Arabic in the ISIS videos. But in reality, the words of the Quran, which are spoken in Arabic, are often the same type of ideas and the same type of language that we hear in the Judeo-Christian ethics here in the United States of America. So we really just share so much in common. But because we're different, sometimes people forget that.
Well, I think that's a very upbeat and important note on which to end. Congressman Thomas Suozzi is a freshman Democrat from the state of New York. Congressman, thank you so much for your wonderful insights. We wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.